Chapter 44. Among the New Buddhists. In the late 50s and early 60s, my work among the New Buddhists, as the followers of Dr. Ambedkar, who had converted to Buddhism, was sometimes called, had lain mainly in Bombay, Nagpur, Pune, Ahmedabad, and Jalalpur. The Ahmedabad Buddhist community was a comparatively small one, and of its adult members, only a small proportion were actually practicing the Dharma, as distinct from not practicing Hinduism, while an even smaller number of them were attempting to extend the movement of conversion. Tiny though it was, this little band of youthful activists was divided into factions, and I was obliged to devote part of the time Terry and I spent in Ahmedabad on our way to Delhi to settling the various personal differences that had arisen since my last visit. Such differences and the factionalism to which they so easily led seemed to be endemic to the Ahmedabad Buddhist community. They had arisen more than once before, and if the activists and their friends did not take the teachings of the Buddha more to heart, they would be sure to arise again. During the 5 days that Terry and I spent in Ahmedabad on our way back to Bombay, all was well, and everyone cooperated to make the visit a success. On our arrival from Baroda at 5:30 in the morning, we were garlanded, given tea in the station restaurant, and shown the Gujarati handbill announcing my lectures, after which we were taken by taxi to the place where we were to stay. This was the home of Amrit Lal, a young unmarried railwayman who had once visited me in Kalimpong, the only Gujarati Buddhist ever to do so. We were accommodated in a quiet and secluded, if rather stuffy, room, where I proceeded to write letters to friends in Bombay, Nagpur and England, and where we were visited, both before and after lunch, by many people. In the evening I gave my first lecture, when I addressed what my diary describes as a good gathering. After the meeting, many people came to Amrit Lal's place to see me. But as I was suffering from a bad cold and a sore throat, and moreover had not had much sleep the previous night, I insisted, so my diary records, on sleeping early. Terry's two-line diary entry for the day concludes, "Mice in room, dung floor." The mice did not disturb me. As for the dung floor, this was a common feature of an Indian home of the traditional type, a thin layer of semi-liquid dung being smeared over the beaten earth and allowed to dry. I was well accustomed to this form of interior decoration, which sometimes extended to the walls, and in fact rather liked it, as it was both cool to the touch and soothing to the eye. To Terry, of course, a dung floor was a novelty, and in his mind it probably had all sorts of unpleasant farmyard associations. In the course of the next few days, I gave 11 lectures in a variety of venues and to a variety of audiences. There were lectures in public halls and lectures at crossroads that had been closed to traffic for the occasion. Lectures in chawls occupied by workers in the cotton mills, and lectures in the alleys between shacks, as well as lectures in a village outside Ahmedabad and a lecture at the university. The lectures were by no means attended only by Buddhists or potential Buddhists. At the Akkanand Hall, for example, where I spoke on Buddhism and humanism, there were many Jains in the audience. Like the lecture on Buddhism and the modern world that I gave at the university 3 days later, this was an English lecture, that is, it was not accompanied by a running translation into Gujarati, the local language. All my other lectures were of necessity so accompanied, for a high percentage of those who came to hear me, especially the Buddhists, far from being English educated, were not even literate in their own vernacular. My translator on these occasions was usually Yashodhara, an unmarried schoolteacher of mature years who had sometimes functioned for me in this capacity on my previous visits. She was a remarkable woman. A Brahmin by birth, she had not only become a Buddhist, but had thrown in her lot, spiritually speaking, with the youthful activists, who were attempting to extend the movement of conversion in Ahmedabad and the surrounding area. Being an outsider, in that she came from another community, indeed, from the opposite end of the caste spectrum, she was sometimes able to extend a moderating influence on her faction-prone Ambedkarite colleagues. Though we were staying at Amrit Lal's place, we did not take our meals there, except for lunch on the day of our arrival. We did not even have breakfast there, arrangements having been made for us to take this meal, as well as our lunch and our afternoon tea, with a different family each day, so that in the course of our visit we saw the inside of more than a dozen Buddhist homes. This arrangement had the double advantage of spreading the expense and the merit of entertaining us more widely, and of enabling us to have personal contact with as many people as possible. It did, however, mean that we spent a lot of time travelling from house to house. Ahmedabad, then the state capital, was a busy place. More often than not, we found ourselves in the midst of a noisy, chaotic stream of cars, lorries, scooters and carts, some of the carts being drawn by bullocks, some by camels, and some by sweating, half-naked human beings. On one occasion, we were stuck in a traffic jam immediately behind an elephant, and I have a vivid recollection of looking up from the cycle rickshaw in which we were travelling to see the wrinkled hindquarters of the great beast looming directly above me. The fact that we took our meals in so many different places not only meant that we spent a lot of time travelling, it also meant we spent a lot of time talking, both to our host and his family, and to the friends and neighbours who came to see us after we had eaten. Sometimes, if it seemed appropriate to do so, I delivered a short sermon of thanksgiving in the traditional manner. All this talking did my throat no good, especially as it was in addition to the lecturing I was doing, and to the conversations in which I could not help engaging after each lecture, the English ones in particular, when I would be quite overwhelmed by people wanting to speak to me. Nonetheless, I was glad we were able to have personal contact with so many people, and thus to learn something about them and the difficulties they were having to face. Breakfast at Ganpatnagar, for example, was followed by discussion with various residents of the locality, among them a Buddhist income tax inspector, in the course of which we had to listen to many complaints about the way in which the scheduled castes were discriminated against in matters of employment and education, and how they lacked all manner of facilities. As I well knew, the complaints were fully justified, and would have been echoed by the millions of people who belonged to the scheduled castes, or who had belonged to them prior to their conversion to Buddhism. At the same time, I felt that the attitude of these particular complainants was more negative and defeatist on the whole than the situation really warranted. I therefore told them that they would have to stand on their own feet and that they could expect no help from outside India, meaning by outside India, the Buddhist countries of Asia. In between meetings and meals, Terry and I managed to do a little sightseeing, most of it on our last day in Ahmedabad. On that day, we visited the 16th century Sidi Saeed Mosque, where we admired the two windows of filigree marble work, the design of which had been described as an imitation of twining and interlaced branches, a marvel of delicacy and grace, and finer than anything of the kind to be found in Agra or Delhi. The third such window had been removed in the days of the Raj and taken to the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. From the Sidi Saeed Mosque, we went to the Subarmati Ashram, where Mahatma Gandhi had once directed the struggle for Indian independence. "Surroundings in terribly slovenly condition," comments my diary. And from there, finally, to the 19th century Huthi Singh Giant Temple, an extensive, rather magnificent structure, the white marble splendours of which testify to the wealth and piety of Ahmedabad's sizeable Jain community. The previous day, two Jain businessmen had taken us to see a famous Jain scholar monk, the 87-year-old Acharya Prem Suri, who lived in a monastery with 12 or 14 other white-robed monks, most of them small boys. The Acharya himself did not say anything. He may have been observing a vow of silence. But we had nearly an hour's discussion with two or three senior members of the community, one of whom seemed to have read something about Buddhism, including Zen. Before we left, they showed us, with understandable pride, the first four volumes of their venerable master's magnum opus, a Sanskrit treatise on the Jain doctrine of karma. Our arrival in Ahmedabad had been accompanied by a certain amount of publicity, and it seemed that our departure would be similarly accompanied. On returning to Amrit Lal's place from the university, where my lecture on Buddhism and the modern world had been followed by a tea with the staff, we found waiting there a reporter from one of the local papers. While he interviewed me, Terry packed, after which we left for the station, in rather a hurry, the interview having delayed us. Amrit Lal, Yashodhara, and other friends were there to see us off. The train left at 6:50. 3 hours later, we had retired to our berths and were asleep. As we had already spent a week in Bombay, and as I wanted to have at least a week in Pune, as well as to be in Nagpur by the 23rd of the month, Terry and I passed only one night in the busy commercial capital of India. Having arrived at Bombay Central at 5:30 in the morning, we took a taxi to Dr. Mehta's place. At 10 o'clock, after I had spent a couple of hours with our host and written letters and made telephone calls, we walked from Malabar Hill down to Chowpatty, and from there, still following the great curve of the Back Bay, to Marine Drive. It was a fine day, with a breeze blowing off the sea. The Tara Porawala Aquarium falling on our way, we spent half an hour admiring the tropical fish, some beautiful, some grotesque, then took a taxi to the grimy Gothic splendours of the Victoria Terminus. Here we had to queue for 2 hours before getting reservations on the Deccan Queen for the following afternoon. Relieved to have got them at least, we cashed some traveller's cheques and had lunch at a vegetarian restaurant I knew, by which time my throat was feeling painfully sore and I was quite hoarse. On our arrival back at Dr. Mehta's place, we found Maheshka's friend Thorat waiting for us. He had come to take us to Worli, he announced. We were expected there for lunch. Though we knew nothing of this arrangement, owing to some misunderstanding on the part of the organisers, as it later transpired, Terry and I had no alternative but to accompany Thorat all the way to Worli. The result was that shortly after 3:30, we found ourselves sitting down to a traditional Maharashtrian meal in one of the chawls. Commenting on this episode, Terry wrote in his diary, "Tea just about coped." Evident that D, quite positive and determined. T, fearful, retiring, and resistant. The misunderstanding over lunch was not to be the only one of the day, as we discovered that evening after my lecture on Tibetan Buddhist meditation. I gave this lecture at Theosophy Hall, the Indian headquarters of the United Lodge of Theosophists, speaking with difficulty for an hour and a half, after which my voice collapsed completely. It was then that we learnt that two meetings had been arranged for us at Worli, an arrangement about which, too, we knew nothing. We went nonetheless. I was unable to speak, but Terry spoke briefly, as did Bhikkhu Srivala Bodhi, an old friend of mine who happened to be present. The following morning we did very little, as I could speak only with difficulty, and moreover had a slight temperature. By midday, however, I felt better, thanks to a short but refreshing sleep, and we went to have lunch with Hilaire Pettit, an elderly Parsi friend of mine who lived not far away on the other side of the Malabar Hill Peninsula. In the afternoon, after I had taken a dose of the homeopathic medicine Hila had prepared for me, Terry and I took a taxi to Marine Drive and from there walked back along the front in the hope of finding something worth photographing. At 4:15 we left for the station, and less than an hour later, having been seen off by Thorat and a number of other friends, we were on our way to Pune. On my previous journeyings to Pune by the Deccan Queen, I had invariably bumped into someone I knew, or who knew me, and this time it was no different. As we climbed up into the Western Ghats, I was accosted by P.N. Rajbhoj, an opportunistic, publicity-hungry Buddhist MP, who had once worked closely with Dr. Ambedkar, but who was now a member of the Congress Party. At Pune Station, Terry and I were met by Maheshkar, his wife Karinar, Amaral, and other old friends of mine, who, as soon as the train stopped, all piled into the carriage and garlanded us. From the train, we were taken to the station restaurant for tea. From the restaurant to the booking hall, where we were given a reception with more garlands and many shouts of Jai, victory. And from the booking hall to the high school playground, where I was to give my first lecture. As I still felt unwell, I spoke for only half an hour. Terry also spoke quite well in his own estimation. After which, the other speeches being over, we were escorted to the Nature Cure Clinic and Sanatorium in Taddiwala Road, just behind the railway station, where we were to stay, and where, on our arrival at 11 o'clock, Terry and I were warmly welcomed by Dr. Mehta's wife, Gulben. The Nature Cure Clinic and Sanatorium had been started by Dr. Mehta in 1929, when he was in his mid-twenties, and over the years he had built up a clientele that eventually came to include Mahatma Gandhi and a number of other leading nationalist politicians. During the last 3 years of his life, in fact, the Mahatma had made the institution his home in Pune, staying with his entourage in the bungalow now occupied by Gulben, which had been named Bapu Kuti in his memory. Since 1953, the year in which he founded the Society of Servants of God, Dr. Mehta had devoted less and less time to naturopathy, though he still saw some of his old patients and occasionally sent them for rest and recuperation to the Pune Institution. By the time I made his acquaintance, he had been living in Bombay for some years, and the roomy, high-ceilinged old sanatorium building was virtually empty, so that he was happy for me to use the place as my headquarters whenever I visited Pune. Thus it was that on the occasion of this, my latest visit to the city of the Peshwas, I came to be staying there once again, this time with Terry, and thus it was that on our arrival at the clinic that night, my friend and I had been warmly welcomed by kind-hearted, hospitable Gulben, with whom, over the years, I had come to be quite well acquainted. Since they had not seen me for 2.5 years, my Buddhist friends were naturally anxious to make full use of me during my brief sojourn among them, and anxious, therefore, to arrange as many lectures and other engagements for me as possible. Though I was happy to be of use in this way for the first 3 or 4 days that Terry and I spent among them, I was unable to do as much as I would have wished, as I was still feverish and headachy, and felt generally unwell. During that time, my friend and I stayed quietly in the big, cool sanatorium, having breakfast and lunch with Gulben over at Bapu Kuti, and going out only in the evening when I gave my lectures. The first of these lectures was entitled Buddhism in England. I gave it in the lane next to Karina's, or rather her father's, house, and it was accompanied by a running translation into Marathi by Maheshkar, as were all my other Pune lectures, except the one I gave the following night at the Western India Club. This was a repeat performance, so to speak, of the one I had given in Ahmedabad on Buddhism and Humanism, and was likewise an English lecture. In the course of the next 2 days I gave 4 more Marathi lectures, one of them at Yerawada, a suburb of Pune, on Buddhism and Ambedkar. According to my diary, this was a particularly well-organised and well-attended lecture, and my audience was delighted, as Buddhist audiences always were, to hear me speaking about their beloved leader, thanks to whose courage and vision they had been delivered from the hell of caste, as he once called it, and led to the feet of the Buddha. The feverishness and headache left me only on the fifth day of our visit, by which time I was already giving two lectures every evening, and Terry and I had started going out a little during the day. One such excursion took us to Pune's leading English bookshop, where Terry bought a copy of the Pelican Schopenhauer, another to the Shani Wawada, or Saturday Market, square, in front of the grim old fortress palace of the Peshwas, of which there remained little more than the tower-flanked main entrance. The biggest excursion of our visit took us to Kirkhalwadi, a Buddhist village situated about 30 miles from Pune and consisting of a few dozen thatched huts, some of which were in a very tumble-down condition. We were not expected, and our arrival with Maheshka occasioned a good deal of surprise and excitement. The men were working in the fields. It was mid-afternoon and a fine day, but the colourfully clad women soon emerged from their dark doorways, many of them carrying children, and greeted us, once they had overcome their initial shyness, with evident delight. While Terry took photographs, Maheshka and I spoke to a few of them, especially one toothless old woman in a green sari. Nor were we allowed to leave until we had taken tea in three different huts. It was from villages such as this that tens of thousands of men over the years had migrated to the city, partly in order to better themselves economically, but partly in the case of the then untouchables, to escape from the virtual slavery of the caste system, which was particularly strong in rural areas. That evening, shortly after our return from Kirkhalwadi, Gulbain gave a tea party in our honour, concerning which my diary has the following entry. Back to the bungalow, that is the sanatorium, by 5, rested and read. At 6 o'clock, tea party. Mother Fisk, Professor Driver, Alu Driver, Mrs. Watchmaker, Mr. Rupawati, the Maheshkars, Father Mascarenas, and others. Quite friendly, but long and unnecessary discussion between Alu Driver and Father M, which everyone else found rather tiresome. Father, indeed, seemed to have lost his mental grip. Mother Fisk looked rather startled. Adele Fisk was an elderly Roman Catholic nun from the United States who was doing research into the religious beliefs of the newly converted Indian Buddhists. She later published a number of useful papers. Of Professor Driver and his wife, I do not have even the vaguest recollection. They must have been friends of Gulbain, and like Mrs. Watchmaker, they must have been Parsis. Quite a few Parsi families had adopted English or English-sounding surnames, some of them expressive of their ancestral callings. Dada Saheb Rupawati, a plump, jovial man of about my own age, was a prominent local politician, a Buddhist and a member of the Republican Party, the party founded by Dr. Ambedkar's lieutenants after his death. He later became a member of the Maharashtra state government, and he remained a friend and supporter of mine all his life. The Maheshkars, of course, were my faithful translator and his short, energetic wife, Karuna. They were both only a few years younger than me, and both before and after their marriage, which I had attended and blessed, they had between them organised many of my lectures in and around Pune. Father Mascarenas, Goanese by birth and about 60 years of age, was a Roman Catholic priest whose enormous paunch threatened to burst the buttons of his white tropical soutane. I had known him for some years through our common association with Dr. Mehta and the Society of Servants of God, where he was the Christian representative, so to speak. I was the Buddhist representative. He was a learned man with a penchant for theological speculation that had more than once brought him into conflict with the church authorities, and led, on one occasion, to his being suspended for a while from the exercise of his clerical duties. Now he was in trouble of another kind. As I had learned from Dr. Mehta, our old friend had become involved with a local woman. Terry's diary reads, "Left for Nagpur at 8:30. Tearful goodbye. Miserable journey. Met by a chattering colleague of D. D had to get out of train until midnight. Poor sleep." The journey was miserable in that, according to my own diary, it was a hot and dusty one that evening and a hot and stuffy one the following morning. The chattering colleague was R.D. Pawar, like Rupawati, a local politician, who joined us at Ahmednagar and travelled with us all the way to Nagpur. Plump and voluble, he was the kind of person who finds it difficult to stop talking even when he has nothing to say. And I could see that Terry found his presence in our compartment extremely trying. The reason for my having to get out of the train was that word of my being on it had travelled up the line, and at every station there were new Buddhists waiting with garlands in their hands. At three or four stations, indeed, there were so many people that I was obliged not only to get down onto the platform, but also to deliver a short speech. In this way, I was kept busy until nearly 12 o'clock. The following morning, by contrast, the journey was very tedious. At 1:30 in the afternoon, we reached Nagpur. There we were welcomed by my old lawyer friend Kulkarni and others, and driven to Kulkarni's place at Dharampath, where we were to stay. Nagpur occupied a special place in the history of the movement of mass conversion of untouchables to Buddhism. It was there, on the 14th of October 1956, that Dr. Ambedkar, himself an untouchable by birth, had inaugurated that movement by reciting the time-honoured formula for going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, together with the five precepts, after a senior Buddhist monk, and then, a few minutes later, personally administering those same refuges and precepts to some 400,000 of his followers. Unfortunately, my invitation having failed to arrive in time, I had not been present at the ceremony, but the following month I met Ambedkar in Delhi. It was our third meeting. And although he was then a very sick man and very tired, he insisted on speaking to me at length about his hopes and fears, mostly fears for the future of the movement he had started. From Delhi I travelled to Bombay, and from Bombay to Nagpur, as I was eager to make the acquaintance of the new Buddhists, who in fact had invited me to spend a few days with them on my way back to Calcutta and give some lectures. An hour after my arrival in the city came the news of Ambedkar's death. He had died in Delhi only 6 weeks after inaugurating the movement of mass conversion to Buddhism. In Nagpur, as in towns and villages throughout central, western and north-western India, his followers were grief-stricken and, for the time being, completely demoralised. What would they do now that their great leader was gone? From Nagpur, thousands of them immediately left for Bombay, where the funeral was to be held. Those who remained in the city, some 100,000 of them, attended the hastily organised condolence meeting that I addressed that night. Dr. Ambedkar was not dead, but alive, I assured my sobbing and groaning audience. He lived on in them. He lived on in them to the extent to which they were faithful to the ideals for which he had, quite literally, sacrificed his life. My words, I spoke for more than an hour or more, were not without effect. Ambedkar's stricken followers began to realise that it was not the end of the world, that there was a future for them even after their beloved leader's death, and that the future was not devoid of hope. During the next 4 days I visited practically all the untouchable localities of Nagpur and made more than 40 speeches, besides initiating about 30,000 people into Buddhism. Wherever I went, I repeated in one form or another the message I had given at the condolence meeting. Ambedkar was not dead, and his work, the work of conversion, must continue. By the time I left Nagpur, I had addressed 200,000 people, and local Buddhist leaders assured me that my presence at such a critical juncture was a miracle and that I had saved Nagpur for Buddhism. Whether or not this was the case, in the course of those five memorable days, I had certainly forged a permanent link with the Buddhists of Nagpur. Nagpur thus occupied a special place in my life, and I was therefore glad to be back in the city again, glad to be there for the 10th anniversary of Ambedkar's conversion, and glad that Terry and I were staying in the outhouse Kulkarni had built for himself in the yard behind his brother's residence, where I had stayed on all my subsequent visits to Nagpur. On the day of our arrival we had no engagements, but the following day was a busy one. At 9 o'clock we were taken to see the Diksha Bhumi, or Initiation Ground, as the 18-acre site of the 1956 mass conversion was called. Thousands of people were already there, many of them having spent the night on the spot. From the Diksha Bhumi, we were taken to the Nagpur Central Jail, where, Kulkarni translating, I spoke for an hour to a very quiet and attentive audience of about 500 prisoners, many of them Buddhists. After the talk came tea, which was handed round by our escort of trustees, that is, prisoners who were serving life sentences for murder. And there was what my diary describes as quite a grand reception. The rest of the morning was spent at the Diksha Bhumi, where Terry and I went round the area with Kulkarni and a few others, despite the intense heat, and where Terry photographed the huge bust of Ambedkar, 15 or more feet high, with its pedestal, which marked the spot where he had stood and recited the refuges and precepts, as well as taking shots of unhygienic-looking tea stalls, turbaned vendors of fried snacks, displays of garish oleographs of politicians, film stars and Buddhas, and families resting in the shade of the bullock carts that had brought them in from the surrounding villages. On returning to Kulkarni's place, we found Dr. M. B. Niyogi, a former Chief Justice of the Nagpur High Court, waiting for us. I had met him a number of times, and I knew him quite well. Kulkarni had invited him and several other members and ex-members of the Nagpur bench and bar to lunch, and these very elderly and very distinguished gentlemen all interrupted one another so often and talked at such cross purposes that I felt like Alice at the Mad Hatter's tea party, and was not sorry when lunch was over and I could spend some time talking with Terry and making a few notes for the lecture I would be giving in a few hours' time. The meeting celebrating the 10th anniversary of Dr. Ambedkar's historic conversion started at 7 o'clock, but it was not until 8:30 that I was called upon to speak. G.S. Talwatkar of the People's Education Society translated for me, and I spoke for an hour. Afterwards, I was told that 200,000 people were there that night, but as the only illumination came from the floodlights on the stage and the strings of feeble electric bulbs on the periphery of the vast gathering, I could see only a fraction of them. I have no recollection of what I said on the occasion, but I must have spoken about Ambedkar's achievements, about the significance of the movement of mass conversion inaugurated by him, about the importance of actually practicing the Dharma, and about the need for unity, it being common knowledge that both the Republican Party and its religious counterpart, the Buddhist Society of India, had split into a variety of warring factions. Though I do not remember what I said that night, I have a vivid recollection of the vast blackness of the sky, of the faces of the thousands of men and women seated on the ground directly in front of me, and of the evident satisfaction with which my words were received. The next 2 days were filled with interviews and visits, one of them to a nearby vihara, as well as two legal tea parties and a little reading. On the morning of the third day, the fourth since our arrival in Nagpur, Terry and I were escorted to the bus by Kulkarni and a young monk of my acquaintance, and soon after 7 o'clock we were on our way to Jalapur. The journey, which was a long and bumpy one, in the course of which our luxury coach, as Terry in his diary ironically terms the battered old vehicle in which we were travelling, stopped 3 times for tea, and we saw monkeys, vultures, and a good deal of jungle. At 2:30 in the afternoon, we reached Jalalpur, where we found a number of local Buddhists waiting at the bus station to receive us, and where we spent 2 nights, one at a hotel, and one with Taranath Bhagat and his family, with whom I had stayed once or twice before. During our short stay, we were taken to see a vihara that was under construction, and a small temple, both of which were picturesquely situated on hilltops on the outskirts of the town. The vihara was the scene of a small function at which I made a speech, while at the temple I installed an image of the Buddha and gave a short address. Both at the hotel and at Bhagat's place we had many visitors, and though again suffering from a sore throat, I was obliged to answer a host of questions. Most of the questions were quite inane, our visitors, with the exception of one bright young man, all being quite dull and unintelligent. In the afternoon of our second day in Jalalpur, Terry and I visited the railway hospital where Bhagat now worked, and met Dr. Chetty, the physician in charge, and an Indian Christian nurse married to a Chinese Buddhist. The nurse was evidently a woman of character. She had 5 children, she told us, and her husband worked in the circus. That evening she came to see us, and we talked with her and others until midnight. At 12:30 we left for the station, where she and Bhagat helped us get a 2-berth compartment on the Kashi Express, when it at last arrived at 2:30. We slept until 7, and at 4:30 in the afternoon, after an uneventful journey, reached Varanasi. Half an hour later, we were in Sarnath.